You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, with just 48 hours to go, can François Hollande smell victory in the presidential elections? We'll talk once again to Christine Ocrente. Austria's credit rating is reaffirmed as AAA. We assess Europe's small and stable success story.
Nowadays, everybody wants to do business with Russia, with Poland. Poland was the only country which had no recession at all. So the main point is we were the first there.
And in our weekly Meet the Neighbours slot, we visit a business which loves to keep it local.
We're really lucky. I mean, there's so many great independent shops still in Marylebone, which is great because it's never boring. You never know what you're expecting.
All that, plus I'll be joined in the studio by an award-winning Turkish novelist, plus a song or two. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The disgraced former press baron Conrad Black has just been released from a Florida prison today after ending his sentence, but he's immediately taken into custody by US immigration officials. A spokesman for US Immigration and Customs Enforcement confirmed Black was in their custody. It's believed he'll be deported to Canada rather than Britain, where he may face eviction from the House of Lords. A spokesman for the UN peace envoy Kofi Annan insists his Syrian peace plan is on track despite reports of continued violence in breach of the ceasefire. Ahmad Fawzi told a UN meeting in Geneva that bringing peace to Syria will be a slow process, saying observers were horrified by the level of violence they saw on the ground, but things were gradually improving.
There are small signs of compliance. Some heavy weapons have been withdrawn. Some heavy weapons remain. Some violence has receded. Some violence continues. And that is not satisfactory. I'm not saying it is. But there are signs on the ground of movement, albeit slow and small.
France has repealed a sexual harassment law today on the grounds that the definition of the crime was too vague, sparking renewed debate of an issue put into the spotlight by the arrest of one-time presidential hopeful Dominique Strauss-Kahn last year. Some women's groups said the decision by France's highest constitutional body would leave victims without legal protection until a new law is penned, while others argued an improved law could lead to more convictions. The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso and the European Union commissioners will not attend the Euro 2012 Football Championship in Ukraine over concerns about jailed opposition politician Yulia Tymoshenko. A spokeswoman said the EU wants Ukraine to guarantee access to independent medical treatment for Tymoshenko.
We want to send a signal to the leadership of Ukraine that we hope they will take steps very soon to improve the situation and indeed to normalize the situation. And that is the signal that we have sent.
The fate of a dozen US troops linked to a prostitution scandal in Colombia ahead of a visit by President Barack Obama will be decided within days after an investigator forwarded his recommendations today to the general in charge of the region. Local elections here in Britain have resulted in the opposition Labour Party gaining 30 councils. The Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition suffered setbacks. The Conservatives lost 12 councils but gained Winchester. The Liberals lost one council and nearly half their councillors. However, in the race for mayor here in London, Boris Johnson, the Conservative candidate, is leading his Labour rival Ken Livingstone in first preference votes by 4%. We'll have more on the final result as soon as it comes in. And finally, prosecutors in New York say a man who impersonated his dead mother as part of a property scam using lipstick, manicured nails and even an oxygen tank at a meeting was convicted of fraud and faces up to 83 years in prison. Thomas Parkin, who's 51, was found guilty of 11 criminal counts, including charges of fraud, grand larceny, perjury and forgery for his scams. Along with the property fraud, Parkin and a partner cashed his mother's social security checks every month for 6 years, stealing about $44,000. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Four. Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan. The time is 5 minutes past the top of the hour, and you're listening to Midori House.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Well, in their coverage of this week's French presidential elections, there's a standout phrase concerning François Hollande in the papers. He is smelling victory. Indeed, his latest rally has been bathed in warm sunshine and smiles. The incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy, meanwhile, has been quoted in the Times of London as acknowledging that he could be beginning another life outside politics come Monday morning. There remain fewer than 48 hours to go before voting. So for our final update before polling day, let's head once again to Paris and to our election commentator Christine Ocrente. A very warm welcome back for the final time before polling day, Christine. What have the two contenders been doing in the last frenzied hours?
Well, they have been campaigning. You know, what else? Hollande made a point to go to Moselle, which is an eastern province, where Marine Le Pen, the extreme right leader, had come ahead of him. And so that was meant to symbolize his will to unify the country and so on and so forth. Sarkozy chose to go to a place where he has a very large lead on the first round. And his speech was very strange indeed. It was quite violent. He talked against the media. He talked against the elites, all those who have treated him badly. And so, you know, obviously, it hurts, and it's really the end of a very, very violent and quite vicious campaign.
It is indeed. I mean, the great thing that was symbolised or that came across on Wednesday's enormous television debate between the two men was the aggressive nature of Sarkozy and the really quite grim insults that they hurled at each other.
Yes, but that was part of the challenge for both of them. Hollande has to prove he's presidential, he has the nerves, he has the stature, and that's why, you know, nobody really knows much about the man. He hasn't been a prominent figure in French politics at all. He was more in the sort of backroom. And so it's important that people realize, and it was particularly important facing Sarkozy, the incumbent president, that people would realize that he's really up to the job and up to Sarkozy, that he was able to confront Sarkozy. And Sarkozy also had to try and destabilize Hollande. So Sarkozy, who's already quite nervous and jittery by nature, had to try and push the guy around and yet not appear too much of a killer. As a result, if everybody agreed that both candidates have mastered the figures and everything else, Hollande came out as the winner, if only because Sarkozy could not manage to kill him politically.
You mentioned there that Hollande is trying to show that he has the nerves and stature to be a president. There's articles in the French press saying that he is trying to directly channel the spirit of François Mitterrand, the last socialist president since 1995.
Oh, yes, that's been very, very amusing, really, from the very beginning. You know, Hollande starting doing primaries, you know, the socialist primaries. He's been talking like Mitterrand, gesticulating like Mitterrand, dressing like Mitterrand, dyeing his hair like Mitterrand, and of course, calling upon Mitterrand's ghost. You have to remember that Mitterrand, who himself came from the conservative bourgeoisie, but Mitterrand in 1981 had brought the left to power, which hadn't happened for years and years. And so what was very interesting too is that Hollande not only would invoke Mitterrand as his role model, but he would draw back Lionel Jospin on the front stage. You know, Jospin, who had been humiliated by Marine Le Pen's father back in 2002. Yesterday, for instance, in Toulouse, Hollande and Jospin were both on stage, and it was a way to signify, okay, the left is back, and let us forget about our scars and our previous defeats.
Hollande is also pleased today by the fact that the former cabinet colleague of Sarkozy, François Bayrou, is now saying back Hollande, despite the fact that he has not had a pleasant word to say for him beforehand. How is that going to affect Hollande's chances of victory on Sunday?
Well, I think it's marginal, but it shows that the conservative right is already in trouble, if not in shambles. In French politics, the centre, the centrist movement, led by Bayrou, has always been allied to the conservatives. Back in the 1960s, 1970s, for the first time, the leader of that shrinking movement, because Bayrou only got about 9% of the votes on the first round of this election. But for the first time, Bayrou called and said, oh, I will personally vote for Hollande. And so that's really a turn in French politics. But I don't think it will have that much of an impact in terms of numbers. I was just looking to a poll before talking to you. It seems that as far as Bayrou's voters are concerned, you know, those 9% who voted for him, there'll be about one-third going to Sarkozy, one-third going to Hollande, and one-third going nowhere.
When we look at the latest polls, François Hollande is still very much in the lead, but the incumbent president, Sarkozy, has been cutting the gap to 6 points. This is a sign that the margin is being cut. I mean, is it enough for there to be a very tight race on Sunday?
No, I think it will be tighter than expected. You know that since February, really, Hollande has been credited with about 8 points, to be 8 points ahead for the second round. I don't think he will have that wide a victory, but there's no way for Sarkozy to catch up, 5 to 6 points between now and Sunday. There's just absolutely no way. And I think one of the lessons is that Sarkozy, strangely enough, entered the campaign very late in the calendar. And in doing so, he wanted to imitate Mitterrand, because Sarkozy is also a great admirer of Mitterrand, a novel tactic, but somehow it hasn't worked.
A lot has been made of the fact that although Marine Le Pen and the Front National have distanced themselves from both Hollande and Sarkozy, Sarkozy has been making a great deal of the wooing the far right. Has Sarkozy's protectionist tone possibly been one of the factors that may contribute to the death of him?
I think it has really very badly damaged his image. I think it has very badly damaged the ethics of politics, given the fact that the extreme right has always been a poison in France. And that, of course, dates back to World War II, Vichy and all that, plus Algeria. Okay, so it's a very painful, distasteful, difficult issue, and Sarkozy followed the advice of one of his people. His entourage was quite divided about such tactics, but that's the one he chose. It didn't work enough, and also it will be a stain, I think, on the history of his 5 years at the Élysée.
He's also been recently adopting a more and more scaremongering tactic in his rallies. I think yesterday he said 2 days of lies. I think this is the final campaigns of François Hollande that he's referring to. 2 days of lies for years of suffering, and also advising the French people that in the middle of an economic crisis to change direction would be an absolute disaster. He's not necessarily gone on a terribly positive footing, has he?
Well, frankly, there's nothing much to be positive about. And Hollande knows that perfectly. You know, what strikes me, having witnessed quite a few of those elections, you have no enthusiasm in the country. Of course, people who, you know, militants, people who, activists, people who work for either the Socialist Party or the Conservative Party, they're in full gear. It's normal. But in the country, when you listen to people, when you listen to normal people, they are, you know, they know the country is in a very bad situation. They know there's need for reforms, for structural reforms. They know they will be painful. They know there's a crisis. And so there's a great deal of gloom. And Hollande and his people know perfectly well that starting Monday morning, their task will be a very, very difficult one.
So finally, do you think the French will be voting with their hearts or their heads this weekend, Christine?
Well, I think they'll be voting with their legs, because then they'll have to go to the booth. There isn't much passion in this election. I think they will. This campaign has been really a referendum against Sarkozy, and it will be so on Sunday. People who may not at all be and by his program, however vague his program has been, people will go and say, I don't want to see any more of Sarkozy. And that is, I think that will be remembered as the distinctive mark of this presidential campaign.
Christine, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Christine Ocrente in Paris. And Christine will be joining us again, fingers crossed, on Monday, as she has every day this week, for a post-election roundup after the big vote on Sunday. You're listening to Midori House. It's 17 minutes past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with some music.
Monocle Films take a cinematic look at the ideas explored in print and on air. Premiering this week, Hugo McDonald reports on the Salone di Mobile in Milan to reveal a change of mood and focus in the design industry.
Despite pouring rain on the streets of Milan, this was a thrilling Salone, and there's a shift in the focus of the industry. Process is being analysed more than product. Funding was a more popular topic than furniture, and designers are back in control.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
Hey, do you listen to Monocle 24?
Monocle 24 is packing its bags this weekend and heading north to Stockholm. Join Editor-in-Chief Tyler Brulé and me, Design Editor Hugo McDonald, for The Globalist and The Briefing, live from the heart of Stockholm. As well as the latest news from around the world, we'll be dipping into the people and projects shaping the Swedish capital in the 21st century. So grab a coffee and a kanelbulle and tune in at 7 a.m. Central European time, and later at 1300 for The Briefing.
Så på måndag, lyssna på The Globalist och The Briefing. Tack och hej!
It's just nudging 19 minutes past the hour here at Midori House in London. Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Time for a bit of music. This is The Signal by AM and Sean Lee.
I don't care.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Well, it has one of the lowest employment rates in Europe and, more significantly, one of the lowest youth unemployment figures at less than 10%. So what's Austria's secret? In the teeth of the European downturn, the ratings agency Fitch has reaffirmed the country's stable outlook and its AAA rating. To tell us more, I'm joined by the prize-winning journalist Michael Bachner from the Austrian paper Der Kurier in Vienna. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Michael. What, simply put, is Austria's secret?
Hello from Vienna. I have two answers. The first answer is Fitch gave us a rather good outlook, but Standard & Poor's destroyed our national confidence because they took away the third A of the AAA in January. So this is the first point. It's not all, not everything is gold in Austria. And the employment question, this is the better part of it. Yes, it's true. We have the lowest unemployment rate in all of the 27 European countries. The reason for that is that we give rather much money into the qualification programs, especially for young people. And therefore, we have roughly spoken about 70,000 people at the moment who are sitting in classes in schools and in courses, learning something, whatever, languages or whatever. And so they are not part of the official statistics. So it's always, the medal has two sides.
I'll come to the youth unemployment question in a moment, but just a moment ago you said that Standard & Poor's downgraded Austria. It did it to lots and lots of countries in Europe, and by comparison, Austria has not suffered as badly as other European countries in this recession, has it?
Yeah. That's true, and the main reason for that is that we are very strong linked to the German economy for roughly 60 to 70%, if you put all together, like exports, imports, connections, and all that, and these two countries are the markets didn't follow the downgrade that much because we are supposed to be a safe haven for the money. You understand what I want to say?
I do know exactly what you mean. When you mentioned there the strong ties to Germany, that has always been the case, hasn't it? Because the Schilling was always always as hard as
exactly,
a Deutschmark, wasn't
exactly
it?
Exactly what I wanted to say. You just put it a better way. Yeah, yeah. It's exactly what I wanted to say. It was the same with the Netherlands in the 80s and 90s, but the Netherlands suffered from political problems the last months with their unstable government, and we didn't have this political insecurities. We have growth again, and for example, the deficit in Austria is again below 3%. So the market said, we don't believe in Standard & Poor's. Moody's and Fitch still have the AAA for Austria, so we believe in Moody's and Fitch, like the government does, and says everything is fine in Austria, we still invest there.
The geographical situation of Austria has always been quite important as well. Do you think it's strong because it's opened up its traditional markets with the former Eastern Bloc, and just to make sure that it always maintained its trade links even after it joined the euro?
Yes, that's true. The main point here is that we opened our markets so soon, so early. Nowadays, everybody wants to do business with Russia, with Poland. Poland was the only country which had no recession at all. So the main point is we were the first there, especially in our neighbor countries like the Czech Republic or Slovakia, but even further to the east. And if you're the first, you have the big advantage because all our banks are now there and the big industry companies. Every Austrian euro was double or three times invested in the east.
What about inward investment from high-tech companies? Because in the 1980s, all you needed to do is drive down the Autobahn and you saw huge Sony factories, which were the first to come into Europe at that time.
Yeah. With high-tech and R&D, we have a little bit problem. This is my main critique with the Austrian criticism on the Austrian situation. We did a quite job quite good job up to now, but looking to the future, I'm rather pessimistic that we can stay on our course because the government doesn't invest enough into future topics when you're talking about high tech and R&D and all that stuff.
When you're talking about future topics, though, a moment ago you were talking about youth unemployment and the fact that they invest heavily in young people. Explain the system and why it works so well.
The system consists of two parts. First is the employment, the education part. We have the system of a double education scheme, which means half of the time the young people are in the company are employed in companies, and the other half of the time they sit in the school and learn mathematics or to write German. So they have good knowledge from the company before they start with their real job. So for 3 years they already work half time in the companies, and the other part is that the government 3 or 4 years ago gave a kind of education guarantee to all people under 18 in Austria, which means that if you don't find a company which employs you for this three-year education scheme, then the state gives you an education place in state-run companies, so to say. These are special organizations or special institutions which give so to say jobs and education to young people. So the main issue is no Austrian under 18 has to live on the street. It's not said that all the people that come out of these schools then have a real job and a good paid job, but it's better to put them in schools and let them stay in the system than throw them out of the system with 16 and then having all the drug problems or alcohol problems or whatever you get then.
What about Austria's governmental investment in the tourist trade? Because it does impose a tourist tax, does it? But it also gives grants to leisure facilities.
Yeah, the tourism industry is huge in Austria, especially in the winter. There is no big investment into it. From the state side, from the government or the governments on the local areas, it's all run privately. There's total free market, and in every little village, which a lot of English people, British people know, you have mountain and skiing and hiking industry, so to say. It's highly developed like Switzerland. There are no subsidies for these companies.
Michael Backner from the Austrian paper Der Kurier in Vienna, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you very much.
29 minutes towards the top of the hour here. You're listening to Midori House. And in the next half hour, we'll hear from one of our editors on the line from Paris. And we'll chat with the author of a new book called Honour. And seeing as it's Friday, we'll go and meet some of our neighbours. Before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Thanks very much. The disgraced former press baron Conrad Black has just been released from a Florida prison today after ending his sentence, but he was immediately taken into custody by US immigration officials and it's believed he'll be deported to Canada. A spokesman for the UN peace envoy Kofi Annan insists his Syrian peace plan is on track despite reports of continuing violence in breach of the ceasefire, saying that bringing peace to Syria will be a slow process, but things were gradually improving there. France has repealed a sexual harassment law today on the grounds that the definition of the crime was too vague, sparking renewed debate of an issue put into the spotlight by the arrest of one-time presidential hopeful Dominique Strauss-Kahn last year. Some women's groups said the decision by France's highest constitutional body would leave victims without legal protection until a new law is penned. The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso and the European Union commissioners will not attend the Euro 2012 football championships in Ukraine over concerns about jailed opposition politicians politician Yulia Tymoshenko. And here, local elections in Britain have resulted in the opposition Labour Party gaining 30 councils. The governing Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition suffered setbacks. The Conservatives lost 12 councils but gained Winchester in southern England. The Liberals lost one council and nearly half their councillors. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan, and he'll be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of the world news headlines. Time now to check in with one of our editors to see what's catching their eye this week. Today I'm joined on the line by our Acting Edits Section editor, Santiago Tarditi. Santiago, we normally have you in the studio, but you're on holiday, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in Paris, Emma.
So many thanks for taking time out from your holiday to tell us what you're doing on your holiday. Santiago, as our Acting Edits editor, what are you doing in Paris that is that sort of would catch your eye as the Acting Edits editor?
Well, I'm eating a lot, as per usual. Let's say it's part of my job to always check out new restaurants and new bars, new cafes. And there are a couple that have really caught my eye during this trip.
Go on. What's caught your eye on your belly?
My belly, yeah, definitely. That's growing as well as my appetite. I went for lunch to a restaurant called Agape Substance. This is a small restaurant that seats only 24 or 25 people. It's in the heart of the Latin Quarter, not far from the Odeon Metro. It's run by a young chef, 30 years old. His name is David Touton. He was formerly at the Mugaritz, one of the best restaurants in the world, and he serves deconstructed dishes that are very artistic and have a touch of molecular gastronomy. But it's a type of food I wouldn't usually go for. But in this case, I have to say it's very, very good food.
What is the mood among Parisian restaurants at the moment? Obviously, you're on holiday, so you're not really supposed to be answering this question, but what's the general mood about Parisian restaurants? Because when the world's 50 best restaurants were announced earlier on this week, I think you were at the award ceremony for us, the highest rated one was the Atelier Saint-Germain, and behind that was Chateaubriand, both of which have been around for a really, really long time. And one could argue that they haven't really been at the cutting edge here.
Well, I was talking to the chef at the Agape, and he said that he was very happy with his restaurant's performance because it is a very avant-garde bet for Paris. Paris is a city that is very traditional when it comes to cooking. It's always focusing on traditional cooking and served at the bistros and brasseries. So this restaurant has only been running for 8 or 9 months, and it's proved to be very, very successful, fully booked every night. So I think he's happy, and I think he's going to open a new road for young chefs to explore.
How has he managed to make it successful whilst steering people away from the more traditional approach?
Well, of course, there were a lot of foreigners there who were a bit more interested in international cuisines, and I guess the locals who dare to try his menus. This is a place that you have to go with an empty stomach and a full pocket, because a tasting menu will serve on average 20 or 30 dishes per person, and it costs approximately 100 euros. So it's people that have a certain culinary culture that are willing to go and try these new projects.
So obviously you haven't been able to indulge in that level all day, every day, or perhaps you have on holiday. Where else have you been eating?
So the first night I went to a place called Hotel du Nord.
On the Canal Saint-Martin.
Yes, exactly. So the food was less interesting, but it's a nice venue along the canal. And then I went for a digestif at the Chez Prune, that is nearby. And I also had a very nice meal at a place called Au Passage. This is in a small street very close to Bastille. It's an unassuming bar à vin, so a wine bar that serves menu formulas that include a starter, a main course, and a dessert. And they cook with very modern type of techniques. So, for example, the veal yesterday was cooked sous vide, and they served the starter that was a salmon sashimi with pickled radishes, creme fraiche, and a couple of flowers and fresh herbs and grass.
I know that street very well, where Au Passage was, because I used to live on it, and I remember that the area in itself is on the border of the very trendy Marais district, but it's quite an unassuming little place around there,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, definitely. But it's run, again, by young chefs who are very, very nice and are happy to have people to come and try their dishes.
Is this the way that the Parisians are managing to sort of succeed outside the stranglehold of the central tourist district, is by just moving just a tiny little bit outside the very fashionable areas they can really thrive?
Yes. If you're a connoisseur of the city and you want to try food away from the tourist hordes, you have to find these small places in hidden roads and hidden streets around the city.
Where have you been staying? Not that I wish to jump on the Eurostar and find out where you are, but what's been your choice of hotels? Because that's not always the easiest of jobs in Paris.
No, actually, I had a couple of options, but they were fully booked. Strangely, I don't know if it has something to do with the upcoming elections. But I'm staying at the Mama Shelter Hotel. It's off the beaten track. It's close to the Père Lachaise Cemetery, and it's a bit overdecorated, but it has a great ambient and live music in the evening. So it's a nice place to be surrounded by a young and lively crowd.
And you've been having drinks you've been rubbing shoulders with the rich and famous, haven't you?
Well, the first night, Lenny Kravitz was sitting just opposite our table.
What more could a man ask for when out and about in the centre of Paris? What are you up to tonight, Santiago?
Tonight, I'm going to check out Silencio. This is a new club that was opened by David Lynch not long ago. But the last time I came to Paris, I didn't have a time to go and have a drink there because I was working. But now that I'm on holiday, I hope to have a couple of martinis.
Santiago, we will spare you any more torture here on the radio and we'll let you continue with your holiday. That was our acting edits section editor, Santiago Tarditi, taking time, filling up his waistline whilst on holiday in Paris. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 20 minutes towards the top of the hour. Time now for a little bit of music. This is Heaven by Emily Sondé. And that was Heaven by Emily Sondé. We'll be right back on Midori House here on Monocle 24 when we'll be joined by the writer Elif Shafak.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers and politicians changing the urban world. This week on The Urbanist, we take measure of what ads add to a city, from 3D billboards and flashy signage to posters and buses, bike shares and public toilets. Or is it all just a load of visual clutter?
The amount of content that can be put on there is infinite, and the invitation to engage directly via the screen is as changing as rapidly in outdoor as it is in other channels.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's just creeping up to 14 minutes towards the top of the hour. Well, the writer Elif Shafak is Turkey's leading female novelist. She's been awarded the Chevalier d'Honneur des Arts de Lettres and has been longlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction. Her latest novel, Honor, examines the lives of a Turkish family who are based in London but are still tied brutally to the traditions of their home culture. Well, I'm delighted to say she joined us in the studio. A very warm welcome to you, Elif. Let's talk briefly about your book first. It's called Honour, but it examines the whole culture clash, doesn't it, between Turkey and London. Can you explain a little bit more about it?
I think in my eyes, this is, primarily the story of a family. So it takes a closer look at the ways in which we end up hurting the people who are closest to us. the people we love. So I try to follow the trajectory of a family as they move from one city to another. There are four different locations throughout the book. There's an imaginary Kurdish village, there's Istanbul, there's London, and there are bits and, you know, some scenes in Abu Dhabi. But the main bulk of the story, I would say, is in late 1970s in London.
Now, the story involves a killing within a family. Mm-hmm. The murderer is a teenager, and a teenage boy at that. What made you decide to choose that?
You know, I want to take a closer look at the construct of masculinity. I find it very problematic, and I think it's a theme that we don't pay enough attention to, not only in terms of, you know, honor killings, but in a larger context. We talk about women, we talk about gender discrimination. Of course, these are very important matters, but we don't focus too much on what it means, you know, what it feels like to be, let's say, a young man in a strictly patriarchal society. My point is, certainly it's not easy to be a woman in a very traditional, in a very strict society, but I don't think it's easy to be a man either.
Is it obviously made even more difficult when you transplant a family from Turkey and bring it to London, and then you get this great pull between the two cultures?
Mm-hmm. I also added the, you know, the half Turkish, half Kurdish elements, so all of these things are part of the story. But basically, I think I wanted to concentrate on the role of the mothers, you know, because I think many mothers, knowingly or unknowingly, contribute to this patriarchal culture, and many of us raise our sons as the sultans in the family, and that is quite problematic, and in the long run I think it damages people.
How do these women damage the family by raising them as sultans? Does it just basically place these children on a pedestal that effectively places them beyond law in many ways?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, of course, with all the good intentions, I believe, you know, mothers treat their sons differently than their daughters. But to be honest, from day one, it's like that.
No. Sorry, Karen.
So, you know, boys grow up thinking they have more privilege, they have more rights, they have more power. So in this story particularly, it was a challenge for me as a writer, because I'm used to writing about, you know, female characters. I love writing about strong, colourful female characters. But this time it was a male character that was at the centre of the story, and not a very nice character. I want to empathise with him was a big challenge for me.
Now, when you were talking about the fact that this is a teenager who is a killer, and this is within the Turkish-Kurdish community, that is there still an element of respect awarded to those who carry out these so-called honour killings?
As I was telling this story, I was careful not to attribute it to a certain, you know, to a specific community or culture or religion or region. For me, this is very important. I see patriarchy as a very universal phenomenon, and it, you know, operates in different ways in different societies in different degrees. Honor killing is an extension, is an extreme extension of that. When I look at Turkey, for instance, it's a very complex society. On the one hand, you will see lots of women in many areas in Turkey, like the media, advertisement, academia, and being very, very vocal and visible. Yet when you look at politics in the narrowest sense of the term, like when you focus on the parliament, the number of female politicians would be very, very low. So depending on which area you focus on, or which city, which town you look at, you might get a different picture, because it's a very big and complex society.
You're Turkish, but you now live in London. Your novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, almost landed you in prison. What was it that happened?
That was in 2005, 2006, the novel. After the novel came out, there was a trial. This is the story of an Armenian and a Turkish family. And basically, I wanted to tell a very constructive story that focused on the things we had in common, rather than, you know, the things that were different. I wanted to tell the story from a very different angle, through the eyes of women, generations of women in the family. Yes, there was a trial, but in my opinion, it was, you know, just a part of the picture, because I have had amazingly positive feedback, especially from women readers in Turkey, ever since. So I think, in general, most fiction readers in Turkey are women, and they're really amazing.
But you now chose to bring your children up in London and have left Istanbul. How do you balance the cultural influences on yourself and on your children?
If I may say, I mean, I haven't left Istanbul and I can't leave Istanbul. I'm so attached, you know, so emotionally attached to the city. But it's like a pendulum for me. My whole life has been like that, has been quite nomadic, if that's the right word. So I've been commuting back and forth. I feel very free in London and I love the city. I find it very inspiring. I also find Istanbul very rewarding for a storyteller because it's teeming with stories. However, the role of the writer is slightly different in the Turkish culture. Writers are like public figures, which I find a bit hard and heavy sometimes. So this kind of going and, you know, commute back and forth somehow balances me. And I also commute between languages the way I commute between cities.
And how do you place that influence on your children?
You know, it's very interesting. I mean, children, on the one hand, they're so open-minded. Their heart is not, you know, full of biases the way our hearts are. So they're very open to learning, embracing new cultures. Certainly they miss Istanbul, so we try to balance, our stays here and our stays in Istanbul. But to be honest, I love the cosmopolitan, the multicultural fabric of London very much. I find it very precious.
Elif Shafak, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. And Elif Shafak's novel, Honour, is published by Penguin. It's just coming up to 7 minutes towards the top of the hour and you're listening to Midori House. Well, every week here on Midori House, we'd like to meet our local neighbours in Marylebone in London. This week, we head to Kabiri, round the corner on Marylebone High Street. The designer jewellery shop was founded in 2004 and it is apparently advertised as the best place to go when you need some jewellery that will bring you something different from the high street. Our own Fernanda Augusto Pacheco went to visit and spoke to Natalie Kabiri, the owner of Kabiri, who will tell us a little bit more about her shop.
My name's Natalie Kabiri. I'm the buyer and director of Kabiri in Marylebone High Street. We've been here for 7 years and we're a multi-brand designer jewellery store. And we stock lots of exclusive designer collections from around the world. And I guess we're kind of, I mean, we have a similar designer selection to, I guess, something like Colette in Paris or Barney's in New York. It's quite a nice international mix. We also have like young up-and-coming London-based designers as well as more well-known brands. And we're kind of like a one-stop shop for jewellery in that our pieces will be bought by women who require maybe some fine pieces in their life as well as more kind of fashion-forward costume pieces. And we stock a broad mix of genres and we kind of appeal to people who appreciate good design and also like well-made pieces of jewellery. And that's our kind of focus in terms of the designers we choose to stock. So we present quite a curated, tightly edited selection of designers out of the huge amount of designers out there at the moment. And we have a great customer base, one that we've built up over the years, lots of locals in Marylebone as well as internationals. So when they come over, for example, now we have lots of Middle Easterns coming over before Ramadan, they'll be coming in, and I guess like Americans and people coming over for the Olympics will come to us as a destination for good jewelry in London, which is fun because we like obviously meeting those people and kind of getting their viewpoint. And there's usually quite a good energy in the shop. We've just done a trunk show with one of our designers called Privé yesterday. And so every Thursday we try to have a designer come in and meet our customers and showcase their whole collection. So there's more of an interaction between designers and customers. I think in terms of trends, we're selling for like fine jewellery, either very delicate pieces, very fine pieces, almost we call it skin jewellery, so kind of very minimal diamonds, quite minimalistic, well-designed pieces. And then in terms of more kind of fashion jewellery, quite big pieces. It's either kind of big or very tiny, no medium really. We try also not to stock designers who perhaps are too close to the high street, because in London we have a very strong high street, so there's... If anyone's doing something that kind of is a bit too similar to Topshop, we're not going to do it. Or anything too obvious a trend, we're going to try to stay away from. And we try to like look at the trends in terms of, you know, a few months ahead rather than kind of what's going, you know, not too street in a way, trying to be a bit more kind of visionary and thinking, well, where are things going? I think in terms of, I mean, obviously in terms of like small pendants, which we've been selling a lot of over the years, we used to sell more kind of like icons, like anchors and things like that, and whimsical things. And now I think it's moving more towards geometry and minimal things. And that's probably a bigger trend for us, more a move more towards modernism rather than being too retro. I think it's got a bit boring. Marylebone, well, I like all the restaurants. I like the tapisserie, it's like on the bottom bit of the Providores, and that's a really great restaurant. The Golden Hind that we mentioned is good, which is like a really old-fashioned fish and chip shop. Kind of reminds me of my childhood in London when there used to be a lot more. And now this is just one really good one that's actually left. For meetings, I always go to 108 on Marylebone Lane because it's really quiet and you can get free Wi-Fi. In terms of clothing, aspirationally, I love Matches, and also KJ's around the corner is great. But since we've been here for 7 years, we've just seen so many more great shops opening. So it's always interesting for me whenever I catch a moment to go outside to actually see what the latest opening is. I mean, the food offer always in Marylebone has been great. The fromagerie is cool as well. It's kind of, I could go on. Natural kitchen. I don't really stray far, I don't know, too near the Conran section, so I'm not really an expert up in that area, but the Conran shop's good, I guess, and there's a few like little boutiques opposite there that are good. But we're really lucky. I mean, there's so many great independent shops still in Marylebone, which is great because they're not, it's never boring. You never know what you're expecting, like with Daunce or with Malin and Torp. There's always something new, a bit like us, so it's kind of on brand with what we do. So definitely like probably one of the best shopping areas in London now, I think, for sure.
And that was the jeweller Natalie Kabiri giving her microcosmic view of Marylebone in London. That's all for this Tuesday's edition of Midori House. Remember, next Monday's Globalist and Briefing will be coming to you live from Stockholm. But from all of us on the Midori House team, thank you for listening. Goodbye.